So we are here to talk about why customer service is the new marketing. I know it's cheesy to do shows of hands, but just because we'll need the exercise. How many here already kind of know what that means? Oh, good. Well, I'll have to say less then. So, first of all, let me just introduce our extremely esteemed panel here. I am very honored to have been able to pull together this set of people, starting with, on my left, Tony from Zappos. He'll tell us a bit about how they run their business, but it's a phenomenon. Those of you who have ordered from Zappos probably already know. And next to him, we have got Nick Wilder from 30 Boxes, who has some amazing experience from Webshots, the kind of forerunner to Flickr, or a forerunner to Flickr in some ways. And he's going to talk about how they've learned lessons there and completely rethought customer service at 30 Boxes. And then, well, of course, Heather Champ needs no introduction. She runs the community at Flickr and has more stories about engaging with a customer, an avid customer community, than just about anybody I know. First, a quick introduction about what we're talking about. And again, I apologize for my crackly voice. Before we talk about the new marketing, let's talk about the old marketing. If I can figure out how to work this thing. Oops. This is a sequence stolen from Kathy Sierra, but this should look familiar. This is the seduction that we know as before the sale marketing. It's all soft focus and beautiful photography and warm tones. But after the sale, it looks a bit more like this. It's how quickly can I get them off the phone? And companies, large and small, they have massive systems designed to hide from customers. This is what one looks like. I won't name names of companies who employ these tactics. But suffice to say that it's expensive to do all this hiding. So expensive that about 3% of U.S. employees are employed in customer support-related activities. Just to give you an idea, that's roughly the population of Florida. So imagine that all Florida's citizens, residents, are answering your calls. And it still sucks. But wait. Not all customer service sucks. We all can probably point to examples without even thinking about it where customer service is why we show up in the first place. Four Seasons, for instance. Restaurants. I mean, every waiter knows instinctively how to connect with the customer, how to be real with the customer. Apple had this amazing idea. How about if we turn tech support, one of the most painful things that we can imagine, into a kind of private club with their Genius Bar. And they've extended it in some meaningful ways online with their online forums, where they've actually pulled in customer experts to help answer the customer issues. JetBlue's been in the news recently. They did something rather remarkable. Their CEO got up and apologized. He kept apologizing, some would say embarrassingly. And he even published a video of himself on YouTube. And you might be able to see 468 comments of people engaged in an airline. 5 years ago, that would have been, a year ago, that would have been unthinkable. And JetBlue turned a fiasco into a major marketing event. And that's the new marketing. Here's another example. Nintendo, well, they've been the darling lately because they've been whooping with Sony's butt in the gaming arena with their Wii. So they can be a little arrogant. they have reason to be a little arrogant, but when a recent Wii customer with a broken console called their customer service line, their customer service rep discovered that the customer was in Seattle just like they were. And they said, forget about all the usual rigmarole of sending in a special label and going through the process. Just drive it down here. We're in Seattle too. We'll fix it on the spot. Sure enough, she drove the weed down there and it was fixed within the hour. She blogged it. It was one of the top digged items for the week. And so Nintendo, simply by letting their customer service rep use their good judgment, got more good press and more marketing value than they could have in a major marketing spend, major television advertising buy. So here's the big idea that we're going to talk about. Great service, it turns customers into evangelists. And the prescription that we're going to be talking about is how, if you want great customer service, you have to start letting go. Letting go of control, letting go of embarrassment, letting go of really being non-human. So I'm now going to segue into who we are and why we're so passionate about the subject. A year ago, we started my company, Ruby Red Labs, a little side project called Valley Swag, which was a swag of the month club. And we didn't realize what we were getting into with customer service until we started spending hours a day on responding to email. We really wanted our customers to be happy, to the point where some people, including Amy, who's down here in the audience, would actually write handwritten notes with some of the customer service replies. Again, people really respond to this. Here's one of these notes that she sent somebody to apologize for an error in a package. They not only blogged it, they posted it on Flickr. They wrote a short essay about how moved they were. This happened over and over again to the point where our customers started sending us gifts. They'd actually pen comic strips about how much they loved us. And this is just by being real and valuing our customers. Now we're starting a new thing called Satisfaction, based around, you know, our belief that this is a new wave. So that's how we've been transformed by this idea of customer service is the new marketing. Zappos has completely redefined not just buying shoes online, but in some meaningful ways, buying online and how customer service is not a cost center, but a profit center. 30Box is one of the leading online calendars. Maybe I'm saying this wrong, but they have a completely new take on the role of online event management. And they've created passionate users and engaged that to do their customer service. And then Flickr, of course, has been doing this for a long time, really have been an inspiration to a lot of us. So without further ado, I'm going to transition to Tony here, who's going to walk us through some of their secrets of their success.
I guess while he's loading it up, out of curiosity, how many people here have shopped with Zappos before? Looks like a good number. And how many of you heard about it through some sort of word of mouth? Looks like the majority of you. And that's really how we've built our businesses. Our whole philosophy is rather than spend a lot of money on marketing, spend it on the customer experience and let your customers be your evangelists and drive the word of mouth. So for those of you who don't know us, we started out as a footwear retailer. And we recently added some other categories, including handbags, apparel, watches, sunglasses, and we currently carry over 1,000 brands. But for us, even though footwear is our foundation, what we ultimately want the Zappos brand to be about is about the very best service and very best online shopping experience. So maybe 10 years from now, customers won't even know that we started out in footwear. And we've actually had customers write into us asking if we would please start an airline or run the IRS. And so, so we thank them for the ideas and tell them probably not in the next 6 months, but we'll put it on our to-do list. In terms of what customers see at first, it's what they see on our website, and I think these are kind of at least the 24/7 customer service, our 1-800 number, is pretty important for making that initial impression. Most websites, it's pretty hard figuring out how to contact the customer service line, let alone find their 1-800 number. Our philosophy is we put it on the top left-hand corner of every single page of our website because we actually want to talk to our customers. We also offer free overnight shipping and free return shipping, really bringing the shoe store into the customer's home. And we have a 365-day return policy. So these are all very customer-friendly policies, but in some ways they may differentiate us initially, but these are all things that can and will eventually be copied by competitors. So we don't really consider these the things that make Zappos different. It's really what happens outside of the website and outside of when they actually click the purchase button that I think makes Zappos different. And number one is the fast, accurate fulfillment. People get what they ordered, and they don't find out a week later that the item was actually out of stock or that it won't ship for the next 2 weeks. When they actually call our customer service line, the people sound like they actually want to help you, and they aren't from India. We actually teach our customer service people to just act like you're a neighbor and don't worry about sounding too professional or sounding like you're reading from a script. And we actually really just leave it up to the customer service rep to do whatever makes sense for that customer. So the same rep might for one customer be joking around and spending an hour on the phone talking about what they're going to wear to the prom, and then for the next customer be much more formal because that customer likes to be called sir or ma'am. And we really just try to tailor it to the each individual customer transaction. And then the last point is we're not really focused on any one single transaction with the customer. And so it's okay for our customer service reps to spend an hour on the phone with a customer and not have that result in a sale. And if a customer is looking for a specific pair of shoes that maybe we're out of stock on, we will actually search competitor websites and direct the customer to the competitor websites and tell them to purchase from there instead because we're out of stock. And, customers and initially when we bring new employees in, they're pretty shocked by this. But for us, it's really about building a long-term relationship with the customer, not about trying to maximize any one single transaction. What we do internally, we don't have call times. Most call centers are, their productivity is measured on how efficient they are in how many calls they take, how quickly they get the customers off the phone. We don't have commissions for our sales, for our customer service reps, and so they're not trying to push product that they may not be interested in. We run our warehouse 24/7, which is actually not the most efficient way to run a warehouse, but it allows us to get the product to our customer as quickly as possible. And this doesn't happen for all orders because of staffing constraints, but we have many customers that might order as late as midnight Eastern, and because we're running our warehouse 24/7 and because of our proximity to the UPS hub, that package will be on their doorstep 8 hours later, and that's a big wow for our customers and really helps drive that repeat business and word of mouth. We inventory all our product so that we can do things like that, so that we're in control of the entire customer experience. And it's actually interesting because we don't do any drop shipping, but when Zappos first started in 1999, the original business model was to only do drop ship, so we wouldn't have to carry any inventory. So we transitioned from that to a hybrid model where we were doing some drop ship and some inventorying ourselves. And there was a time when drop shipping was making up about 25% of our revenue, and we decided to just give that revenue up completely because if we really wanted our brand to be about service, we couldn't rely on dropshippers. And at the time, that was a pretty hard decision to make, just giving up 25% of your revenue. But it was the right thing for the company, and I think that sometimes you do have to make those hard decisions and not always try to maximize the top line or the bottom line. For everyone that's hired in our Las Vegas headquarters, and basically half all our staff except for the warehouse workers are in Las Vegas, when they are first hired, they go through our 4-week training program where they learn about the company history, the company culture, our emphasis on service, and then they actually take calls for a couple weeks from customers. And it doesn't matter what position you're being hired for, whether you're the CFO, an accountant, or lawyer. Everyone in our company has to go through that. And that really brings the entire company to focus on the customer and really understand the value of customer service. And then we can all speak the same language. And so I think that's really helped our culture and helps bring us forward in terms of making sure that as we grow, we don't lose that customer service focus. We have a culture book in which that we put out every year, and we have employees write a few paragraphs about what the Zappos culture means to them. And except for typos, it's unedited, and we put it all together and hand it out to every employee as well as prospective employees. And that's been pretty good for getting people to understand what the Zappos culture is all about. And I guess probably more than any other company that I know of, we place a lot of emphasis on company culture, because ultimately if that's what you need in order to provide great customer service. If employees don't love the company culture, aren't happy with their jobs, there's no way they can serve customers effectively. And so in the interview process and in performance reviews, fit with company culture is a huge part of it. And if they're not a fit with the culture, even if they're have the best experience and the best technical skills, we won't hire that person. And same with performance reviews. During performance reviews, if they're not a good culture fit or aren't doing something that's good for the culture, then they will get a negative performance review. So those are, I think it's a lot of the stuff that we do internally, especially on culture, are what makes Zappos ultimately effective in customer service. Because once you have the culture down, then everyone in the company starts thinking about how do you better serve the customer. And that's about it. And I guess one last thing, if anyone wants to move to Las Vegas, we're hiring for designers, developers, and community managers.
Thanks, Tony. That was great. One thing that struck me when I first started talking with Tony was this idea of call centers with no scripts. And I thought that spoke volumes about the values that their company has, and it really started to answer the question of why they and so few other companies were able to really connect with customers like my wife, Amy, who I learned about Zappos because of her, because she had a problem with an order, called them up, and she really needed this pair of shoes for a trip, and without any prompting, they said, "It's our fault. We're going to handle it. We're going to ship them to you overnight." And there was no standing on ceremony. It was just done. And she was a customer for life. And so, you know, all this process and all this thinking really is, to me, distilled into this idea of this script-free call center. I think that is emblematic. So next up, we have Nick from 30 Boxes, who's going to talk about their philosophy.
Thanks. Before I talk about 30 Boxes, I wanted to mention my experience at Webshots, which was an enormous contrast to 30 Boxes. I was working there for 7 years between 97 and 2005, and we were really hiding from customers, just as Thor mentioned in the introduction. We had customer service reps who would deal with the customers, and the closest connection that they had to the rest of the company was perhaps submitting Bugzilla reports, or you know, occasionally things would get back to product designers or engineers if there are bugs, which was a really dissatisfying system for everybody involved. You know, customers often didn't get things fixed. Engineers didn't know things were broken and things would stay broken for a long time. Products would stay, they would have design flaws that we just didn't think about because we weren't listening to customers. And that was really dumb, and we just didn't learn the lesson. But I think it's surprising how obvious that seems to me now, but I really think that it seems to be the way most or a lot of websites are still working, which is pretty amazing, because it's just not that hard to do a lot better. Those are some stats about 30 Boxes up there. An important difference with Tony's experience is we're providing a web application, so we don't have the same kinds of issues. Most of our issues are with questions or bugs or suggestions about how to change our website. And a relevant fact is there's just three of us, and we really like to sling code. We're not super duper careful, so we release a lot of bugs, as you can see, or you can guess from how many code releases we do. The rest of these, there's a couple more slides now, just to, they're excerpts from our forum. All of our support goes through the forum. This guy, sorry for all the text, but this is a pretty typical, this happens pretty regularly. We make a mistake or help somebody out, and people write back, and this is, you know, publicly posted for everybody else to read, and when one person writes something, generally a lot of people read it. And I think this is one that we're, you know, I was pretty, or most happy about, and I think this is speaks to the title of our presentation here. This guy just loves us now, so not only is he a fan, but he's going out and asking other people to donate on our behalf, and, you know, we accept small donations, and it's just kind of a thing just for fun. We give people a star if they donate us some money. But, you know, you can't do better than having your users ask other users publicly to support you and help you out. And there's a lot of, I think, fears when you decide to put all your dirty laundry out there in a public forum, and, you know, you open yourself up to people criticizing you or people comparing you to other companies and pointing out your flaws. And, you know, that happens. That happens pretty regularly. But in our experience, people have always jumped to our defense. If you really are inferior to another company, you know, maybe you should be listening to that anyways. But we admit mistakes all the time, and people acknowledge it, and, or, you know, they're happy that we fix it, and we don't seem to be losing customers. We, in fact, seem to be gaining their trust, because we actually are, you know, we show that we listen, we show that we respond, and it seems to actually be a win-win situation. We get to be, we get to put out more features faster with less testing, and our users sort of help us out. Next slide. Again, a lot of text to read, but, a user had a problem. Typically what happens in a forum is another user will jump in and try to help them, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. In this case, a user, Jamie, tried to help a user, Chris, and it didn't work. So I got involved and tried to help out Chris, and I couldn't help him just because it was a problem not entirely related to our site. And Chris wrote back, and this is long, but it's important, because he did four things. In his first sentence, he thanks me for looking into the problem. In a second sentence, he says he's going to go tell Google about the bug that we think it's a problem with them, which is cool. This guy is actually going to, you know, try to resolve the issue on his own through a third company, which is something I probably wouldn't have taken the time to do. He next thanks another 30 boxes user, so we have this beautiful halo effect between users on the site actually helping out each other and then thanking each other and acknowledging each other. And lastly, he says he hopes this will help the other GCal users and 30 boxes users. So this guy likes us, he likes the fellow users, and he cares about our other users on the site that he doesn't even know. So we have this super duper sort of feel good thing going on. You know, and you can bet that Chris is going to get his friends involved, and when people read this stuff, they feel confident that, you know, this is a site you can trust, and it's worth helping. The last thing is just, we've been amazed at how much goodness has come out of this forum. You know, engaging our users, our users have been really engaged, and it's been a virtuous cycle for us. They've submitted Grease Monkey scripts. Sometimes these scripts are so cool that we actually take the code from them and just put them into the site. You know, having users help each other obviously saves us a lot of time. That's a pretty nice thing. We have gotten legitimate feature ideas from users that we hadn't thought of. And we've even added code, and people have found bugs and CSS little things on our site, and they post it in the forum, and we take it. And, you know, there's three of us. We can't possibly test every browser, every language. We have people all over the world that tell us their crazy combinations of things, and you know, we can reproduce it if they can, if they give us the exact scenario, we can reproduce it. But there's lots of things, you know, no company can test everything, so it's great to have your users helping you out.
Thank you. One thing that really struck me when we first talked was this one stat, which was at WebShots, 50% of the issues went unresolved using a traditional trouble ticket system. Using a forum-based system, like they use at 30 Boxes, 50% of the issues are resolved by other users. Think about that. By giving up control, you do less work, and your customers are happier. That is a profound concept, and we're seeing it over and over again. So, Heather. Heather Chapp is at Flickr. She runs the community there, as I've said. And that's right. She's got a great overview of the way they run community there. Or I should say customer service, which is increasingly blurred.
Good morning. So you may have seen this at times when you come to the site. Certainly something we don't want people to see. And I think our philosophy, how we kind of deal things and sort of the real core team, what we believe is, and that we ask everybody to be helpful, authoritative, human, friendly, inclusive, transparent, honest, funny, and clear. And these are really the core values not of customer care, but really in the heart of all of the Flickr team members. We actually randomly found out a bit of background about this picture, that there is an average height to a developer. Some of my coworkers are disappointed when I say, if you remove the statistical anomalies, like the shorter and the taller, I think they're all, I can't remember what the actual number was, but I think 5'9 is the average height of a Flickr developer. We have a number of different ways that we sort of engage with the community. We have a help link that's at the top of every page and a link to this that's in the footer. So help is at hand. We try to have different channels. People have different comfort levels of how they want to communicate with you. We have a help by email where you can select a topic, drops down. If you're familiar with the system, whatever topic you select, we try to provide some feedback on to help you sort of try and resolve it without contacting us. There are also links. We've set up search criteria to bring up the most recent forum activity that might address this situation. This system is something that the team can access on the fly, so if something goes very wrong, we can put in a new question so we can provide feedback this way. We also have a site status message that we can change as well to let people know sort of, you know, is it us or is it you, that kind of thing, feedback. We also have forums. We have three forums at the moment. We have Flickr Help, Flickr Bugs, and Flickr Ideas. And these can be really active. And it's very, you know, I'll kind of wake up in the morning and I can get a sense of what the mood is of the community based on the kinds of topics that are coming through. It's a really great immediate feedback loop if something is going wrong, because it comes up, you know, we've got so many people actively uploading. We actually have over 1 million photos uploaded a day now. So a lot of people are actively participating on the site, so if something goes wrong, it comes back to us this way. We don't need to wait for help by email. We can see what's going on, and we can kind of, if it's on a Saturday morning, I can wake somebody up and make them fix it, or, you know, we can work with the team to resolve the issues. This is a photograph of my laptop. I will confess that I did edit out a few crumbs that were stuck in the keyboard because I'm really not the neatest person. But a core... in addition to our philosophy, something that I remind myself continuously is soft, pleasing tone of voice. This is actually something that originated from... actually, I just realized I shouldn't probably say this. How we talk to our dogs, you know, like, soft, pleasing tone of voice. Soft, pleasing tone of voice. But really, I think it's really key in terms of a reminder that... So as an example, So when we, if we're going to make a change to the site, or if we release a new feature, or if we know there's a bug, we open what is an official help topic where the community can come and participate. If it's something like a site-wide bug, we'll put a notice in the top of the page linking to sort of the official topic so people can really participate in what's going on. We're very present in the forum, so as we have updates, we'll go back in and you can see this... If you're not aware, we're requiring as of March 15th that our old school members, our remaining old school members, those people who joined before August 15th, 2005, who are still signing in on the old sign-in system, had to have to merge with a Yahoo ID. And so we announced this on January 30th, and I think at last count there's 2,650 comments in this topic. And it's been a real roller coaster. If you've got like a few hours and a bottle of booze and, you know, really nothing else important, it's kind of, I think this is a really excellent, you know, really taking the temperature of the community and listening to people. We really will take all comers and we really want to give people an opportunity to kind of share their feelings. And what we did in this one as like kind of we saw sort of like the same questions coming in over and over again, that we started putting these in and editing it, linking to specific points. Because when you actually have a 2,600-page, you know, this 2,600-comment topic that is, like, paginating to, I don't know how many pages it is, people are like, you know, this is out of control. So we really look at being present. Everybody on the team is an active member of the site. They have their own photo streams. We really... anybody who's answering you through customer care, if you get something from Anna, Anna Zavala. If you get something from Manish, it's from Manish. Like, we really, we are who we say we are. If you go to the About page, you can see every single person who works on the site. And so we're actively present and communicating. Stuart is still very active, and he'll come back in. So this is, you know, I think just really key in one of the things that differentiates Flickr or initially was very different was that people really participated. They really, you saw the people who were building the site actively engaging with the community rather than being this kind of vacuum where, you know, people just feel that like they're putting stuff into the wild and nobody's really responding. And so I just want to have a couple of examples of just kind of, this is one key example of when you run a large community site, there is chaos inherent in the internet, and it's you can't assume nothing is ever going to go wrong. And I think the idea is when things go wrong is how to do the right thing. On July 19th, 2006, last summer, we were in the office. We were still down in the Mission College, and... you know, we really try to schedule our downtime and sort of let people know when the site's going to come down, when we have to do work or something like that. And the thing that just drives fear into my heart is like when we need, when we have to go down. And it was, we had the sort of a storage failure that was quite, or could have been quite catastrophic. So we decided to take the site down. And instead of our usual Flickr's having massage, we decided that we were going to host a coloring contest. And so the regular Flickr's having massage page was replaced by this notice. And so I don't know if you can quite read the copy. Our tubes are clogged. This was right after the whole tube clogging episode. Because this sucks, we thought you might like to enter an impromptu competition to win a free pro account. Just print out this page and color in the dots. When the site's back up, take a photo of your creation and post it to Flickr tagged with Flickr Color Contest. Team Flickr will pick a winner in the next couple of days, and that lucky duck will get a free year of pro. And then seriously, we apologize for the unannounced downtime. We're working as fast as we can to get Flickr back online. Details here. And that details here link went to Flickr blog, which is run on a separate system, so we can keep that going. And this is the post. That's the beginning of the post. Actually... you can't see that. There's a URL at the bottom of where this is. And so we had, I think it took about 30 minutes from the minute from when we sort of had to go down to switch out the Flickr's having massage page to go here. When we came back, within 24 hours, we'd had 1,100 photographs that had been tagged with Flickr coloring contest. I don't know if you can see it. My favorite one is the stormtrooper holding up a picture of the coloring contest page. It was just really engaging to see how people responded to this, from torturing their pets, sticking their heads through, like kittens with their heads jammed through the clogs. A lot of people printed out and drew on it. Some people took it into Photoshop and did things. And it was just really interesting. In the end, we felt that given the response, we couldn't give away just one pro account. And so we gave away 14 year of pro. And then anybody who had tagged their photo, we gave them 3 months of Flickr Pro. And we sort of announced that. So, and I can't remember the actual, I guess it was, you know, I think, you know, 1,100 people plus got 3 months of pro. And there was really great response to this. And it, I think, you know, we wanted to, you know, it really sucks when, you know, in the middle of the day, you know, unannounced, everything's going to go away. And why we did this is we really didn't know at that point how long it was going to take for us to come back up. So we wanted to sort of engage with the community. So this was kind of something we'd done and kind of, you know, made lemonade out of a whole big bag of lemons that were handed to us. And I guess lastly, we really have remained transparent. We try to be really honest. I think we confess and kind of fess up to when we do things wrong. This is a blog post that Stuart wrote back in July 2005 that I think really kind of epitomizes how we want to be really clear and upfront and just really be honest and that we really still are people who are engaged and really want to provide, you know, the best photo sharing site and we're always going to, you know, fess up when we kind of go very wrong. So that's the last.
Thanks, Heather. That was great. I think that's actually a great note to end the presentation on because it's something that we've been talking a lot about, which is just the role of the apology, the role of saying sorry has really started to change because not too long ago, what you were really worried about was the liability, the legal liability of not coming through with your customers, you know, baiting and switching your... There was so many reasons, so your lawyers told you, I won't name names, to not actually apologize. You'd say everything but I'm sorry. But today on the internet, if you don't, then there are thousands of people ready to blog about how you screwed them and how you don't get it. And so I'd be interested to hear how some the two of you and have use the role of the apology to gain unusual advantage with customers.
Yeah, and we do occasionally send out wrong orders for whatever reason or mess up on something that we shouldn't have. And we leave it up to each individual customer rep to use their best judgment in how to make things right. And so it could be something as simple as overnighting a replacement or giving a coupon, but it's really up to the individual rep. And there's really nothing that any supervisor can do that the rep himself or herself doesn't already have the power to do. And you know, depending on the extremity of the situation, we've gone as far as even sending flowers to the customer. We had one case where there was an error in our database, so we sent the wrong pair of shoes 3 times to the same customer. So we finally figured out that it was a coding issue, but you know, we wanted to make it right for the customer, so we gave her the shoes for free and sent flowers and you know, had, I think, 3 or 4 different people in the organization, from the rep to the supervisor to the CFO, all call her personally to apologize and explain the situation.
Since there's only a couple of us, a lot of times we don't get to support issues right away, but we do read our forms pretty regularly. And if it looks like there's something urgent, like somebody says, or if, say, 3 people say, my calendar's down, please help. I don't know what's going on. You know, calendar data is sometimes pretty critical if you want to know what you're doing. You know, we get on it right away and we try to, you know, if we're not in the middle of something else, sometimes we can fix a problem within like a few minutes of it being reported. And, you know, that just blows people away that people are actually paying attention and responding that fast and addressing to their problems. And that is actually sometimes like our most serious bugs have turned people into our most serious fans because we addressed them quickly and appropriately.
Yeah, we had an experience. Sometimes the way to handle a situation is unusual. For instance, with Valley Swag, we announced a policy called the deputy program, where we would deputize certain members if they became kind of vocal in their support. They blogged about us, flickered their packages, etc. And we had this violent reaction to that. In retrospect, it made sense. I mean, we were basically offering preferential treatment to some people if they shield for us. And so we very quickly backed off and posted a blog post and said, here's some different ideas of ways we can give away the extra swag that we have lying around, which was the whole reason for the deputy program in the first place. And we gave five different ideas and let people vote on what they liked. And everybody, I mean, to a person who we had been threatening to walk and leave the community, got really into this debate about what was the best of the five options. So just that engagement with the customers, letting them feel part of the program, was really, really powerful. I'm curious, how there's this interesting conflict, I think, or tension between the interest of high touch customer service, which is clearly the gold standard for businesses. We know it, we see it. The Four Seasons style customer service, which I think, Tony, you really embody with your whole approach. And the ability to scale it when you're a small team, small company. And we're seeing how Nick's doing that. But I'm interested to know if there are, where that tension kind of breaks down a little bit, where, for instance, you can't keep, you can't answer enough calls. You can't spend enough time, or the cost basis breaks down, or the forums aren't high touch enough. I mean, are there areas where that breaks down a little?
Well, I would say that delivering great customer service is definitely expensive, and our call center is one of our biggest expenses aside from, you know, the shoes themselves. So I guess there's a choice that you have to make, and it's what you want your business to stand for. In retail, typically, you can compete based on price, on service, or selection. And I think for any business, generally, you can achieve at most two out of the three. And so we've chosen service and selection, and we're not the place where you can get the best discounts, or, you know, the lowest price shoes. And it's just making that choice to invest in growing the customer service of your organization that we've made. And, you know, it's not that there are plenty of businesses that have bad customer support but are still great businesses. You know, Walmart's a huge organization and doing fine from a business perspective. It's just a choice you need to make for your own business.
If I could have gone back and done and thought about Webshot's customer support again, which had several orders of magnitude more users than 30 boxes, I would have organized it to have engineers always, and product managers for that matter, always working with the customer service people. I think people are reluctant to do that because engineers cost more. They take them away from developing their new products, but they can achieve, well, for certain web companies that are application oriented, they can achieve so much more and actually satisfy problems so much more efficiently, I think, that it may work out financially beneficial, and it certainly has, you know, intangible benefits related to the customers that far outweigh their cost.
Here's a different kind of question, but I think it's an important one. How do you deal with crazies? Because there are a lot of them out there.
You have the most crazies.
Yeah.
People are very passionate about certain topics. No, it's true. And I think it's important to... And so part of my soft, pleasing tone of voice is to kind of remind myself not to get angry, realize when I need to step away and take a break. I think eventually somebody who's really going for it will just make themselves look ridiculous. And at a certain point, if you can weather through the storm, it eventually will work itself out. That is, of course, saying that a key to any community is really having firmly established community guidelines. And if somebody steps across that line, we really do try to work with people, send them a warning. If somebody posted something completely inappropriate, I'm quite willing, you can throw anything at me, but I'm not going to let you throw anything at anybody else in the forum. And if it gets to the point where I call it trout slapping, that old Monty Python, that wonderful one with the people and then hitting each other and just kind of, giving the heads up as the referee. I've also kind of position myself as a referee going in and saying, blowing the whistle okay, you need to step back from the abyss because if this keeps going, we're going to lock down the forum. I think you need to let people have at it as long as it's as you, but just not at other members of the community.
So but what about when it comes to actually clicking the delete button? Where you they're such a pest, they're actually ruining the community. I mean, again, the problem, the danger these days is that you're gonna create an enemy, and they're gonna go and they're gonna torch your reputation in every way they can.
Yeah. In the forums, we only delete spammers out of the forums. You wake up and it's like some other dating site where somebody's really just not getting it. We can very infrequently block people from posting in the forums. So if you're going to be a complete dick, you're going to lose your right to participate in that forum.
Yeah.
And that's not irreversible. Sometimes people just need, a timeout to kind of reset, realize that it's going on. And I think it's just not rising to the bait, because a lot of it is people are really just trying to engage with you because it feeds something for you to be talking back to them. And so I think that's really key. Okay. And I have asbestos underpants.
We have a couple questions over here. I think.
Yeah, thanks for the great panel. You've talked a lot about the community that's surrounding your services and things, but I'm interested in how you foster that community and culture within your organization to provide that great kind of customer service. And two quick things were that, for example, with Flickr, the other day I ambushed Heather in the hallway with a problem that my girlfriend had with the service, and immediately she apologized, and immediately then she fixed the problem. And that's surprising, and I think surprise has a great bit to do with how customer service is received by people. And at Zappos, I remember last year I had the most remarkable customer service call I've ever experienced, I think. Remarkable in two ways. It's the first customer service call I ever talked about human trafficking on. And the second one was, it's the first one where I've made a sale. And it's because I was working at a small nonprofit that deals with modern slavery. And after the person called to verify credit card information or something, she said, "Tell me about your organization," because I was getting my shoes shipped to my office. It's called Free the Slaves. It's a little, it stands out. And she said, "I think I donate to you guys." And we had a much longer conversation about the work we were doing then than what she was, ostensibly calling me about. And then she said, "You know what, I'm going to call back after my shift and I'm going to make a donation." And she did. And that's, not only is that great customer service, I think, but it's really surprising. And how do you engender such a culture within your organizations?
I think it's careful hiring. So you were talking about culture fit, and that's really important, is taking the time that as you grow your team to make sure you're hiring the right people. And we are hiring, by the way, we're looking for designers. Stuart asked me to say that. Somebody comes in an interview, they kind of meet with 8 or 9 different people, and there are a number of times where I've been meeting with people and there's this pause and they're like, "Wait, you're the culture fit interview, aren't you? With people kind of, but you really want to make sure that as you're building it out, you really are finding the people who really have the same values. And then it's much easier. We also, when anybody joins the team, they need to work in customer care answering. Like they all have to answer 10 to 20 customer care questions a day and really kind of understand how the community talks to us, how we respond back. And I think that's really key is getting everybody to understand how important it is that you can't, oh, like, I'm just a developer. I'm above all this. It's like, well, no, you're not. You need to really, we're all part of the same team. We're all in this together. And everybody has to understand the importance.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. In terms of culture fit, we've formalized it in our company in terms of core values as well. And we have 10 core values. One of them is to build a team and family spirit, and that goes along with being friendly, whether it's to your coworkers and to your customers.
Hi, I guess I have a slightly more specific question. I was wondering, how did you develop your cancellation policies within this culture of great customer service? As I run a subscription-based web service. We're a live online astronomical observatory, and we have a yearly subscription. And we have the forum. My CTO and I are in there all the time. We're very available. We're great with everything about customer service, except my CEO says, we have to hide. We have to make cancellation a little harder, and they have to call our customer service guy. And I was just wondering, this is sort of a debate we're having, and I don't like it. And I was wondering if you could give me some ammo for talk to him about it.
Tell him he's a bad, bad man.
Yeah.
Really. There's a delete button from the account page where you can delete your Flickr account. We do have a firm no refunds policy. Because it's $24.95 a year, it can be more expensive to deal with the refund than it is. But we would much rather try and make things right to engage people. But that's just evil. That's just, don't be evil.
Yeah.
you have to be comfortable to let people go, and if you want to make sure that the people that you have are there because they want to be there, not because you're holding them hostage. And I think, there's that, we were talking about the, AOL, like canceling your AOL account, and there's that audio of somebody who's like, I went through the same thing, like 20 minutes to stop them taking $19.90 whatever a month out of my account. It was just, and you just have to go through so many hoops. It shouldn't be that hard. Like the longer it, like the every additional minute, you spend on the phone is more and more hatred and anger and like the bad sort of the word of mouth that's spreads through somebody having a bad experience is exponentially greater. They're more likely to go out and say, AOL those fuckers, as opposed to, somebody just, like, I had a really great experience. It's just...
One way of asking the question is, would you be comfortable if this was a known policy on the, externally?
Right now we have just email customer service and we do cancel it in about 10 minutes. It's not like it's the AOL experience. We're not so evil and, that's his. No, it's okay. No, it's just, we do our best to not be evil, but I think they, I think if we have the cancellation button in the My Account section, that's a vote of confidence. That's saying, if you want to, go ahead. We don't need you, I like the no refunds policy. That makes sense because, then we get into a whole prorating debate and, for half the year or whatever. So that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, I want to make it easy.
Yeah.
And thank you for giving me this ammo. I think that'll be helpful.
Hey guys, I'm Ryan Carson from DropSend. And we do a lot of customer service. And Nick, I have a question for you. When you say you have 80,000 users, you said, is that active?
It's 85,000 signed up, confirmed email addresses. We got about 25 to 30% of our users in any given 30-day period. So maybe 20 to 30,000.
So how many man hours do you spend a week doing purely customer service?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's surprisingly few, and that's why I kept emphasizing how many bugs we put out, because...
And let me clarify that. I also mean like time in the forums and answering emails.
Sure. So I generally let the forums build. I let some issues build up for, you know, 3 or 5 days, unless something looks urgent, and then I'll take care of it right away when I see it. But it's on the order of 4 to 6 hours a week. It's not a big deal, and that's why I really feel pretty strongly that people should get engineers involved in this, because, you know, 30,000 active users in a month is not a huge number. Many, many sites are much bigger, but it's not insignificant. And we have, you know, a fairly important data set to people. So when, you know, when there are problems, we feel that it's important to get it back. And so I think it's surprisingly cheap and, you know, low cost to actually address problems really quickly and get them solved, so that you don't get a buildup of issues and a bunch of people to deal with.
Cool. So did you ever not have forums and then have forums, or have you always had forums?
At 30 boxes, we've always had forums. That's the only way we've ever done anything.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's worth underscoring the idea that there's sort of a range of approaches here. 30 boxes, team of 3 people, right? Mm-hmm. There's all customer service via forums, no email. And he spends 4 to 6 hours a week. That's a stunning number. So if you're a small web app company or a small e-commerce company, that's something to look at. Next.
Hey, my name is Lionel Menchaca. I'm the blog manager for Dell's corporate blog. So I can say, living through it for 8 months, I've seen just about everything in terms of negativity.
Oh, don't say that. You're wishing some bad. You always think it's gotten as bad as it can,
Let's just say I'm used to some negativity at this point. I can say that. But first of all, I wanted to thank you guys for this panel. It's been very helpful, and really, I think you guys have done a lot to show people here that we need to get out of the mindset of thinking of customer service as a call center. Sure, there's a cost associated with it, but what we're starting to see with the blog and with IdeaStorm and with our forums and everything we're doing. We're starting to see the change happening where we're getting supporters on the blog and that is something I know we're going to hope to continue and focus on. But my question was for Tony, in looking at your list of items that that you guys have instilled as policies, one of the things that stuck out was the 365-day return policy, and I wanted to ask you, from a business standpoint. How has that worked out? I know obviously it costs you money to offer that kind of policy. What's actually the take rate in terms of how many users actually tend to use that, or is there any abuse that you see, and how do you offset that? Is it worth it from a customer service perspective?
Yeah, we actually started out with a 30-day return policy, and then we extended that to 60, and then 90, and then 365. I would say the vast majority, probably 85 to 90% of our returns did come back within the first 90 days. The rest kind of trickle in over the next 9 months. And actually, if you ask really nicely, we'll even accept returns beyond 365. So.
Wow, well, I have to say, very impressive to see how you literally orient your company around all these things. Very impressive.
Thanks.
I want to thank you also for the panel. As a consumer who wants to advocate great service, I'm frustrated with these aggregate services that the only way you can sort companies is by price. Have you worked on a metric that makes it easy for these aggregators, these sort of shopping aggregator sites, to have another button they can sort on that would be service? And how would you quantify that? Have you started to think about those sorts of things?
That's a great question. I think that some of the traditional good seal of housekeeping, there's some better business bureau type stuff, but none of them have been aligned yet around quantifying customer satisfaction in any meaningful way. Having said that, I know that Tony uses a metric that is that an organization that
for quantifying
customer.
Yeah, we look at a few different things. We look at our BizRate ratings and look at likelihood that the customer would buy from us again. The other thing we look at is this thing called the Net Promoter Score. And if you do a search on Google for Net Promoter, you can find out more information about it. But it's basically a very simple question. It's just, would you recommend this company or service to your friends, family, or colleagues? And it's a 1 to 10, or how likely would you do it? And it's a 1 to 10 scale response. And basically, the methodology is you look at the percentage that respond with a 9 or 10, and those are the promoters of your company, the evangelists, or really passionate customers. And then you ignore the 7 or 8, because those are just passively satisfied customers. And then the 1 through 6s are your detractors, and you basically subtract the percentage that are your promoters from, or you subtract the detractors from the promoters, and you come up with a score. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but supposedly in the U.S. across all industries, the average is around 10 or 20%. I think anything above 40 or 50% is good. At Zappos, we've been running at about 82. So,
next.
Hi there. Yeah, great panel. My name is Justin Ha, and I work on the Google Reader team at Google. And I just actually wanted to make a comment that we've been talking about these forums on the sites, but then there's the rest of the blogosphere, and a lot of people make comments on their own blogs. And I just kind of wanted to offer a tip that. On the Reader team, what we do is we subscribe to blog search feeds for topics for in our case Google Reader, and then we essentially know within an hour if anyone on the web has mentioned Google Reader, and we can then go and follow up on the blog and answer their question or respond to whatever concern they have, and we found that's been a really good thing for Reader and people really like that sort of engagement.
That's an amazing point. If you track your blog mentions and you go and you add a comment when somebody's written about you, particularly when it's something bad, and you don't get defensive, you just respond in a kind of human way, it's amazing what happens. When we were doing this, people would freak out and become almost instantly a huge evangelist for us, because they were just amazed that we would come to them. So it's a really valuable tip.
I've just got a question. I really love the Zappos model of customer service and how you're going above and beyond. And I'm working with a company that's got a very similar model to that, where they do anything for the customer, an open-end return policy. You can do it, 3 years from now. It's so much focused on the customer that they make $1.6 billion a year in profits. They have a fierce, loyal customer for life. But it's at the expense of the employees. They pay the employees like $7 an hour. You don't really get benefits. There's not a break room. They hire fantastic people to work at this company, and then they burn them out by trying to deliver above and beyond customer service. So my question is, you're doing customer service as the new marketing, but how do you also do customer service for your employees so that you can continuously give better service but not at the expense of your employees?
I guess our philosophy is you need to spend the money on your employees, and so we pay our employees at or above market wages. We give them a great set of benefits: full medical, full dental, free lunch every day, and so I think it's really it's not cheap, and it's a decision that you have to make, because what you don't want are people that are coming into the call center, working there for 3 to 6 months, and then leaving for the next call center that's paying 25 cents per hour higher. And we do invest a lot in training our employees. One of our core values is to make sure that employees are always pursuing growth and learning. So we give them a lot of opportunities to grow and learn more and increase their pay. I think you just need to make the decision to invest in your employees, and then, that kind of dictates other areas of the business, other constraints of the business. And so for us, for example, because we invest so much in customer service, we can't be a discount site. And we know there are plenty of customers out there that we're losing because we don't offer 40% off shoes. And you just got to decide your priorities, I guess.
Well, it looks like we're out of time. I want to thank everybody for coming to our early morning panel. I want to thank my esteemed panelists. And I want to tell you, you have the power to do this to your business. You have the power. Go forth and do it.